I'd like to begin this morning by noting what is oftentimes our greatest Achilles heel when it comes to learning the narratives of the Torah, and that is our education. What I mean by that is we oftentimes have the zechus of going to day school and learning from our kindergarten teachers all the stories of the Bible, specifically the five books of Moses, the five books Chamishe Chamshe Torah, and then we grow up with these preconceived notions of what exactly happened when, you know, we know the stories. Oh, right, we learned from Amoras back in grade school how it all went, and we have these, again, preconceived notions in our mind of what actually took place, and that can often be our greatest detriment. Because our moras, while they're doing a great job for us when we're in grade school, don't always do justice to the text. And when we look back at the text in our adult lives with our adult eyes, the text says something very, very different. So what I'd like to do this morning is go back to a storyline that perhaps you're familiar with, going back to the time when you were in a day school, if you had the privilege of going to a Jewish day school, and revisit this narrative. And the narrative that I have in mind to study with you this morning deals with the Jewish midwives Shifra and Pua. If you would stop a local yeshiva boy on the street and ask him or her what exactly took place with the midwives, so I imagine they would tell you something to the extent of, well, Paro was unhappy with the Jewish population. He turned to two women named Shifra and Pua, who we really know are Yocheved and Miriam. And he said, when you see a Jewish woman giving birth, if it turns out to be a boy, you should throw the boy in the Nile. Does that seem to be accurate? What a random yeshiva boy, yeshiva girl would tell you if you asked them to summarize the story? Fair? I think that's pretty fair. So now I'd like to look back at the text itself to ask a couple of questions and hopefully leave the lecture with a deeper appreciation of what actually took place. So if you look with me in source number 1, this is chapter 1, verses 15 and 16, Perek Aleph, Psukim Tesvav and Tes Zayin. This is after the Torah tells us that Paro clearly is anxious about the explosion of the Jewish people, how large we are in the land of Egypt. Paro turns to his advisors. He said, we have to devise some sort of plan, because if enemies come and attack, the Jews will leave with the enemies. And as much as the backbreaking labor is oppressive, it doesn't seem to stop our population growth. So Paro devises another layer of the plan. And that's where we look at right now. Vayomer melech Mitzrayim l'mialdo ta'ivriot. So the king of Egypt, Paro, turns to the Jewish midwives, asher shem ha'achah Shifra, v'shem ha'shenis Pua. The first one is named Shifra, the second one is Pua. Vayomer, and he tells them, Bialtchem es ha'ivrios, when you are helping the Jewish women give birth, Ureisem ala uvnayim, and you see them on the birthing stone, on the birthing stool, im benhu v'hamitenoso v'imbasi v'chaya, if it's a boy, you should kill the boy, if it's a girl, you should let it live. So let's think about this. Does this make sense? Paro is a wise fella. He turns to his advisors, his cabinet, Hava nischak malo, let's devise a plan to outsmart the Jewish people. So Paro has a brain and he seems to be using it. If that's the case, what part of this text doesn't make a whole lot of sense? Ibio, in what sense? Just explain the question. Yeah, so for... Okay, good, we'll get there. First, excellent question, Ms. Tzadok, correct? So, I just asked her name in advance. I actually planted the question. She didn't come up with that question. That's not true. But the first question is, if Paro seeks to do harm, inflict harm on the Jewish people by killing all the baby boys, so why would she turn to the Jewish midwives and say, oh, you know, my dear Bubby, you know, when you are helping your Enochel give birth, you should kill the boy. Did Paro really think that that would be effective? Turning to Jewish women and asking them to kill their own family members? Very good question. What other questions seem to arise from the text itself? Why the boys? Excellent. That's the first issue I'd like to discuss. Why the wisdom of the plan? Like, why the boys? Why not the girls? And we're going to see that it actually would have made a lot more sense to kill the girls rather than the boys. And one last question that always bothered me is in terms of the practicality of the plan. We've got a nation that is very, very large and growing exponentially. So Paro says, I got to put a stop to this. So he calls in two women, Shifra and Puah. And he says, listen, ladies, between the three of us, we're going to take care of the population growth. You too, whenever you see a Jewish woman giving birth, if it's a boy, you'll kill the boy. How effective could two women be? Shifra and Puah. How effective could two women be to really stem the population growth by killing the boys? Did that question ever cross anyone's mind? Again, we're so indoctrinated with the stories from our youth that we don't stop and ask such a basic question. How could two women actually make a dent on the growth of the Jewish people if they alone were going to kill the Jewish boys? Fair questions? Okay, great. So I'd like to begin by focusing on the two questions. The first one is the wisdom of the plan. That's what it says over here in part one. Why did Paro choose to kill the boys as opposed to the girls? And then the next question that we'll focus on is the practicality of the plan. How effective did Paro imagine his plan to be by turning just to two midwives and asking them to kill the boys? So in terms of the wisdom of the plan, let's think about this. Paro sees this Jewish nation that is growing and growing and growing, and he wants to kill the babies. I understand. And for whatever reason, he's going to choose one gender. Which gender would be more effective to kill off? Which gender would be more effective? The one that gives birth. And the Abravanel and the Gor Arya, which we'll see inside, they are going to point out, I'll tell you right now, I'll ruin the story right now. They're going to point out that it would make more sense to kill the baby girls as opposed to the baby boys. Because after all, one Jewish male could theoretically infect countless Jewish women. As opposed to a woman, she's only able to conceive and carry as many babies, as fetuses are in her womb at a time. But one Jewish male could do a lot of impregnating if he needed to. After all, let's remember, fast forward in Jewish history, Shaul is able to wipe out all of Amalek except for Agag. And from Agag, we build an entire nation of Amalek again. So if we're really thinking practically, and we want to inflict in the Jewish people a real sabotage, we really should have killed the baby girls and not the baby boys. Let's look at the Abravanel as he begins to develop this question. Source number two, for those of you familiar with the Abravanel's commentary, style of commentary on the Torah, he always begins a perek with a list of questions. Sometimes it could be 50 plus questions. So here we're going to look at the sixth question, source number two. Hasheila Havav, the sixth question. B'mashetziva Paro l'miyaldot im ben hu v'hamitenoso. Regarding Paro's commandment to the Jewish midwives, if it's a boy, you should kill it. V'imbasi v'chaya, but if it's a girl, let it live. Ki hasafik b'ribui hazera. If a person has, literally the word safik means doubt, but in this case, I believe it means angst. If Paro has angst over the explosive birth rate of the Jewish people, Yoser Haya Benashim mi be'anashim. It would have made more sense for Paro to have focused his efforts on the girls as opposed to the boys. V'lachin haya Yoser Tov She'amisu Kol Nolad Ben Zachar Ben Nekeva. At very least, Paro should have killed all the babies. O Yamisu Hanikevos V'lo HaZecharim. Or Paro should have said to Shifra and Puah, if you see a baby girl, I want you to kill the girls. I want you to kill the girls. Because you're never going to kill all of the males. Paro knew it was impossible to get everybody, and one Jewish male could rebuild an entire Jewish people. So if you want to really get to the source, you have to kill the Jewish women who will ultimately carry the Jewish children. So why did Paro focus on the boys? Why did Paro focus on the boys? Very good. So You're going to say something in the back? No? Okay. So Rashi brings in the Medrash that you just referenced, that Paro was told by his magicians, his sorcerers, that we ought to focus on the boys because the boys are going to be the saviors. There is going to be one specific savior that's going to come from the Jewish males. That's what Rashi quotes in source number 3. Rashi says, "In Benhu, Lohaya Makbid Ella Al Hazicharim." Paro was only careful about killing the baby boys. She'omru lo itzdagniginav. Paro's advisors, his sorcerers, were able to tell him, "She'asid lihivaleid ben Hamoshia osam," that the Jewish women, one Jewish woman in particular, was going to give birth to a baby boy who would save the nation. Paro had this inside information, so he said, let's kill off all of the boys. Now the Gur Aryeh, the Maharal, in his commentary on Rashi, as a parenthetical remark, we know that Rashi's commentary in the Torah was so extraordinary that it spurred countless, I once heard a fact, someone said over 200 books were written to explain Rashi's commentary on Torah. That's phenomenal. I don't know all 200. I could probably list you 3 or 4. But the point is that Rashi's words are gold. And that spurred a whole genre of commentary just explaining Rashi. So one of the more well-known commentaries on Rashi's commentary, what we would call a super commentary, is the Gur Aryeh, the Maharal. And the Maharal makes the point that we just said in source number 4. She'im b'shvil shelo yarbu ha'am. If Paro's concern was simply the explosive growth rate, haya lo ligzor al hanikevos, Paro should have put the decree on the girls. V'kevan she'ein hanikevos lo yiyu lahem nashim v'lo yalidu. If there are no women, so there's not going to be any more baby boys or any more baby girls, for that matter. Aval im yigzor al habanim. If Paro's decree, which it was on the boys, so it's not going to really decrease the population size. Shehare zachar echad me'aver elef nekevos. One Jewish male could theoretically impregnate 1,000 Jewish women. V'lo yelahem to eles b'gzirasam. And there would be no effectiveness in Paro's decree as long as one little boy is able to grow up. He can regrow the Jewish people. And that's why, says the Gur Aryeh, Rashi needs to supply another interpretation. The simple concern of population growth, and therefore let's kill off the baby boys, is not sufficient, because that if that was fueling Paro's decree, he should have decreed the baby girls be killed, not the baby boys. Now, I understand full well that you really need both, and as long as one Jewish girl would have lived, you could also regrow the Jewish people. But it seems that the commentaries understand, as a very practical matter, it would have been more effective to kill off the baby girls, not the baby boys. So then why did Paro choose to kill the baby boys? It's because he had this information from one of his advisors that a baby boy was going to save the Jewish people. Now, yes? Right. Correct. That's why I said, that's why it takes, I understand that really both, but in terms of what will be most effective, it seems that killing the girls would have been more effective than killing the boys. But the Abravanel himself is not particularly fond of this Medrash Chazal that is quoted by Rashi. And he asks a really good question. He asks the following question. If Paro knew full well that there was going to be a baby boy who would save the Jewish people, then how come he let Batya bring Moshe into the palace? Like, what happened? Did Batya come home one day and simply say, "Oh, Dad, turns out I was pregnant, I had a baby boy who's 3 months old now, but, you know, welcome home to your new grandson"? How did it work? What type of excuse did Bat Paro come up with when she brought Moshe into the palace? So the likely answer is she probably told her dad, "Dad, I found a baby that was abandoned in the Nile, and he's really cute, and I'd like to keep him." And Paro said, "Fine." asks the Abravanel if Paro really was concerned that one Jewish male boy was going to be the savior of the Jewish people, how come Paro let Vaya keep this baby boy? Who, by the way, I don't want to spoil this story for you, he's the one, right? Asks the Abravanel in source number 2, paragraph number 2, V'chazal amru shaparu hayamak b'dal ha-zicharim, l'fisha amru lo itzti giniyav sha'achas min yishe Yisrael haysa sida l'aledes ben she'yoshiyam. That's essentially Rashi's words, that Paro focused on the boys because Paro had this information about the Jewish savior being born to a Jewish woman. Aval asks the Abravanel, im hayu ha-mitzri reyim izeh, if the Egyptians were truly afraid of this, Eich lacha bas paro echad miyaldei ha'ivrim, how could bas paro have taken one of the Jewish boys, v'gadlo bebeis ha'melech, b'tachsise ha'melucha, and allowed him to grow up in the palace with all of this royalty? V'eich lo micho biyado ha'mitzrim, how come the Egyptians didn't make a big fuss over this? How come they weren't concerned that maybe this little Yankel over here, Moshele, in fact he was Moshele, right? How come he wasn't going to be the savior, which he was? So Rashi's Medrash Chazal helps us explain why Paro focuses on the boys, but it falls short in terms of really understanding the dynamics here. So we have to peer even deeper. The Or HaChaim in source number 5 offers a different interpretation regarding why Paro focuses on the boys and not the girls. The Or HaChaim says as follows. I'll share with you outside what he says and then we'll read it together inside. The Or HaChaim says that the advisors who made this recommendation to Paro were very, very astute. And they made the following calculation. If we make a dent in the male population, so there'll be pardon me for using these sort of harsh business terms, but there'll be an oversupply of women who will be of marriageable age. And if there's going to be an oversupply of women and an undersupply of men, so what are the women going to do? They're going to assimilate. They're going to marry Egyptian men. And if that happens for long enough, then what will take place? The whole Jewish people will collapse, not because we've killed them all, but we have assimilated them all. And that's why Paro focused on the boys and not the girls. Writes the Rechaim in source number 5, Vihine, Eitza Chachma Ya'atz Paro Bedavar Zeh Leval Yuchlu Alos Me'aretz. Paro came up with a very wise plan in order to hinder the Jewish people's ability to leave Egypt. Vuhu ki be'emtza'ut she'yahargu kol zachar, through the medium of killing all of the boys, V'yisrabu hanashim, and the women will be quite numerous. And now the Or HaChaim quotes from a Talmudic dictum, Ha'isha tav l'meisav tandu, that a woman has more of a predisposition to be married than men do. So a woman is likely to marry an Egyptian, even if it's not the type of shidduch that she necessarily envisioned. V'yischabru nishe Yisroel im ha-mitzriim, so the Jewish women will ultimately marry the Egyptian men. V'yischatnu bahem, they'll get married. U'me'ata ein mitzios la'alos min ha'aretz, and then there'll be no concern about women and the Jewish people as a whole leaving the land. Kishehayiyu le'am echad, because the Jewish people will ultimately just mold and become the Egyptian people. And Paro said, this is why we should focus on the boys, because the girls will acculturate at a faster rate, at a faster clip than the Jewish males will. Because when the Jewish males, even if there would be an oversupply of Jewish males, I guess the assumption is that they would be able to keep the Egyptian women under the Jewish banner for longer than the Jewish women would be able to do so with their Egyptian husbands. That's the assumption of the Or HaChaim. Yes. Interesting. That seems to call into question Paro's other priority of keeping a nation of slaves. It's a fair point. Or HaChaim doesn't address that. He doesn't address that. That's a fair consideration. The Abravanel in source number 6 begins by echoing the sentiments of the Or HaChaim. From a chronological perspective, they were not echoed at all. The Abravanel lived a few hundred years before the Or HaChaim, but he says the same point, that he assumed that the women essentially would have to marry Egyptian men, and they'd be pushovers, and they'd end up having to take on the Egyptian culture. And I say the word pushover on purpose because there's a tremendous amount of irony in this, isn't there? Because ultimately, which gender is the reason why we're able to keep on having children and growing? It was the Jewish women who refused to be pushovers. But Paro thought he was dealing with a lighthearted type of population, and the women would simply marry Egyptian men, and that's not the case at all. It's the Jewish women that are the reason why we were able to continue procreating and growing. And ultimately, the Abravanel himself makes the following very practical observation. You know why Paro focused on the Jewish boys? What was Paro's concern? What does the text say? I should have included the pasuk. I'm sorry that I didn't. When Paro voiced his original concern about the explosive rate of growth of the Jewish population, they're going to join our enemies. They're going to join along in the battle. So who was fighting the battles in those days? It was the men, not the women. So the Abravanel says the most practical answer is that simply Paro was most anxious about the future battle that the Jews would join along with. So who are the ones doing the battling? It's the men, not the women. Writes the Abravanel in source number 6, just to pick it up in the middle of the second line, towards the end. Kol shekein shehachashash kulo haya bezecharim ki heim im yirbu yilachemu ba'aretz. If there'll be a war in the land, v'ya'alu mimena, and the Jews will leave. V'ein kein hanekevos, which is not the case when it comes to the Jewish women, ki einan ba'alos milchama. They're not the ones that are waging war. And that's why Paro focuses on the boys, not the girls, because the boys are the future soldiers, not the women, at least not in those days. So now we essentially have three different reasons to explain the wisdom of Paro's plan. Why does he focus in on the boys and not the girls? If it's purely motivated by population growth, at least according to the Mefarshim we saw, it would have been more effective to focus on the girls, not the boys. If Paro focuses on the boys, it must be for one of three reasons. One of three reasons. Number one, he had information about a future savior of the Jewish people coming from the Jewish males. Number two, he was hopeful that the Jewish women, when they could not find a mate in the Jewish people, would turn to the Egyptians and acculturate. And number three, the most practical of them all, he was afraid of war. And the Jewish boys would be the future Jewish soldiers, not the Jewish girls. And that's why Paro says to Shifra and Pua, when you see the Jewish women giving birth, and it's a boy, kill the boy, not the girl. I should correct myself. I believe I said earlier, he turned to them, the Jewish midwives, and he said, throw them in the Nile. That was not yet taking place. At this stage, Paro was simply asking the Jewish midwives to kill them on the spot. It's only after this plan is not successful that Paro says to everybody, you see a Jewish boy, you should throw him in the Nile. So that is the first part of what I'd like to discuss, why Paro focuses on the boys and not the girls. But now let's turn to the second question that we asked in terms of the practicality of the plan. We have a nation that is a couple of 100,000 strong, right? When Moshe takes the people out of Egypt, so he's 80, and there's 600,000 men or so. So this was about 80 years before that. So we could assume, let's say, there were about 400,000 strong, give or take. A little bit less than that, sure. So we have a nation of, let's call it 350,000 men, an equal amount of women. How effective could two midwives be? Oh, the supervisors, excellent. But before we talk about supervisors, let's talk Rashi. What does Rashi say? So Rashi says, in fact, these were two women. Says Rashi in source number 7, Shifra zu Yocheved. Shifra is a reference to Yocheved. Al shem shemishaferes as havlad, because she would smooth out, make the child look more presentable. As you know, if you've been zocha to have a baby, you know that they are all gooey when they come out. So it was her job to clean off the baby before giving it back to the mother. Pua zu Miriam shepoa umidaberes vihogel livlad. Kederach hanashim hamefaisos tino kabocha. Pua is related to the word pa, like poo, 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 like quieting down a child. And that's why the word pua is used in the context of a midwife. So Rashi says, Shifram pua, we have Yocheved and Miriam. Before we go on and discuss how this is troubling because it's only two women, let me just ask you a question that also goes back to the point that I started with. We take the words of Rashi and the biblical story so for granted that we don't ask basic questions that we should. The Kli Yakar asks a basic question. How did Chazal know to line up Shifra with Yocheved and Pua with Miriam? Why wasn't it the inverse? Shifra zu Miriam, Pua zu Yocheved. Okay, so we got two. So switch it around. How do they know to line up A with A and B with B? So the Kli Yakar asks this question. In source number 8, the Chazal amru Shifra zu Yocheved, Pua zu Miriam. V'yesh lehisponin. One has to consider. Dilma ipcha, maybe it's the opposite. Shepua Yocheved, v'shifra zu Miriam. Why can it be the inverse? And who told us that their name actually changed? How did Chazal even know to connect these two women with Shifra and Pua? Vinirali, says the Kli Yakar as follows. Shepua lashon dibur. The word Pua is related to speech. Vizemora mamish al Miriam. Pua was what Rashi said, the sounds that the woman would make to calm down the baby, so it's related to one's using their mouth. And that fits beautifully with Miriam, because we know Miriam was a Neviah, exactly. The Zemor Mamish al Miriam Shahaisa Neviah, Kemo Shamu Chazal Batikach Miriam HaNeviah Achos Aaron. Miriam is described as a prophetess in the Torah. Shahaisa Misnaveis Asida Imi Shetiled Ben HaMoshil Yisrael, because Miriam had a prophecy even when she was young that her mother was going to have a child that would save the Jewish people. So Chazal see a word in the Torah, Pua, that is related to the concept of speech. So it made sense for them to connect Pua with Miriam, a lady who uses her mouth to speak prophecy. Not only just to speak prophecy, but to speak about the prophecy that relates to the salvation of the Jewish people. Just as an aside, it's interesting, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky has a comment in Sefer Bereishis, how he notes that many of the Egyptian names have letters Pei and Ayin. Paro, for example, Yosef is called Safnas Paneach. So the letters Pei and Ayin have a resonance with the Egyptian language. You need someone who has a better understanding of those languages to give you a further explanation. But certainly it would make sense that Pua was an Egyptian name that was given. But Chazal understood to connect Pua with Miriam because of the role of the mouth. What about Shifra and Yocheved? How did Chazal know to connect those pieces? So you could say it was by default. Once we've already connected Miriam to Pua, well, we've got Yocheved, she's got to be Shifra. But Shifra is related to Shefer, to beauty. And we know that Yocheved in Parsha Shemos is described as a bas levi, because she goes back to her original beauty. We know, if you do the math, Yocheved was 130 when she gave birth to Moshe. At least if you go based on the way Chazal understand it. And Chazal say that her body was able to go back to its youthfulness and to have another child, and that's why we connect Shifra to Yocheved. Just to read it to you inside in source number 8, paragraph number 2. Yocheved hainu Shifra al shem shechazra l'shofra v'na'arusa v'yosa basmeya u'shloshim shana. Yocheved went back to her youthfulness, to the ability to her body went back to the ability to have a child. Kiaz haisa shufra me'ayin shufra shel yimeina me'ein shufra shel yimeina arusa. She was just like she was in her youth. Kimosha kara lesara v'gam neze haya mofes she valed mimena ben hamoshiel yisrael. Lo bechinam nasela neze. Yocheved went back to her youth just like Sarah did, and as such, Chazal connected Shifra and Puah to Shifra being Yocheved, Miriam being Puah. Just as an interesting parenthetical remark, the Ramban doesn't believe that Yocheved was 130 when she gave birth to Moshe. Because the Ramban says, if that's the case, how come the Torah doesn't tell us about this miracle? How old was Sarah when she gave birth to Yitzchak? She was 99. She was 90. She was 90, if I'm not mistaken. 90, correct, 90. And the Torah makes a big deal out of the fact that she went back to her youthfulness and was able to conceive a child. So the Ramban says, if Yocheved was 130, that's a much bigger miracle. How come the Torah doesn't tell us about that? So the Ramban rejects the Medrash that says Yocheved was born ben hachomos. The reason we understand that she's 130 is because Chazal say that she was born on the way down to Egypt. So if the Jewish people were enslaved for 210 years, Moshe was 80 when he led them out of Egypt. Yocheved was born when they came in. That means she had to be 130. Ramban says, why doesn't the Torah tell us about this miracle? It should have been noted. I apologize. It's the Ibn Ezra, not the Ramban. The Ibn Ezra says, it must be that Yocheved was born later. She is Moshe's mother. No one's debating that. The Ibn Ezra would just tell you that she was not born when the Jewish people were going down to Mitzrayim. She was born later on as they were in Mitzrayim. And the Ramban disagrees. The Ramban says, no, she was 130. It's the same Yocheved was born ben hachomos. Why does the Torah make a big deal out of it? The answer is, we don't know why the Torah chooses to highlight one miracle and not another miracle. The Torah is filled with miracles, and not every miracle is mentioned. So this is a miracle that is not mentioned. Yes. Correct. That further complicates the matter. Aaron and Miriam are not much older than Moshe. Exactly. So why, that was also miraculous if she gave them in 120. So all these are questions that the Ramban says are not questions. Yocheved was born later on, and she was a regular aged woman to give birth in those days. But the Ramban says the whole thing is miraculous. Okay, Torah doesn't mention it. The bottom line is, this is how Chazal understood to connect Shifra with Yocheved, the beauty of her returning to her youth, and Puah, Zumiriam, the idea that she had the ability to prophesize. And the Kli Yakar says, we have to understand the irony in this moment. Paro is calling to two women, Shifra and Puah, whose names both have resonance, both connect to the ultimate redemption. Shifra went back to her youthfulness to have a child to give that was going to lead the people out. Puah had the prophecy that my mother is going to have a child who will lead the people out. Both names reflect the idea that the Jewish people are leaving, will be redeemed. And it's those names that Paro calls when he tells them to kill the Jewish baby boys, right? The irony over here is unbelievable. In that exact moment that Paro thought that he would be destroying the Jewish people, he calls on the women who are named after the ultimate redemption that would happen. A beautiful insight of the Kli Yakar. The unbelievable insight of the Kli Yakar. Okay, but let's get back to the main story over here. Trying to understand how this ever made sense in Paro's mind. He is going to call two women to a nation of, let's say, 350,000 women. And he's going to tell these two women to take care of all the Jewish babies. Kill them. How does that make any sense? And Rashi doesn't tell you anything further. He just says, two women. Okay, they were very busy. Their pagers were going off every single moment. Okay, it could be. But I think we could also peer deeper. The Svorno in source number 9 builds on Rashi in the sense that it was literally two women, but he also makes the story more realistic with a few comments that he adds. Writes the Svorno in source number 9, La Mialdota Ivriot. Listen to what the Svorno writes. La Osan Shehayu Be'ir Mitzrayim. He turns to the two women who were in the city of Egypt. I don't know what that's a reference to, probably wherever Paro's castle was, if it was in, I don't know, Cairo or wherever Paro's castle was. Maybe there's an Egyptian historian that's coming next to give the next lecture. You can ask him all of these questions. But wherever Ir Mitzrayim is, wherever Paro's castle was. So Paro turns to the two women in his local area. La'osan shahayu bi'ir Mitzrayim. To the two women who were in his region. Ki amnam ba'am holkach ra. With a nation this large. Lo hayu shtei miyaldos bavad. It's ridiculous to consider that there were only two midwives. But after these two women betrayed Paro, interestingly, Sforno calls them Shebagdu b'melech mialdot Mitzrayim. So I'm not sure if he's modifying the midwives being Egyptian midwives, or if he's just referring back to the city. I think it's more likely he's referring back to the city. He say, remember, he called the city Ir Mitzrayim. So the Sforno is writing that after these two women in his locale, in his little town or his city, wherever it was, after they betrayed him and he wasn't effective with these two women, Achar Shadibar Lana Melech Batzmo, Paro gave the orders directly to these two women. They didn't listen. So therefore, Lo Sam Libo, Liftoach B'Mialdot Shahar Mekomos. And he gave up hope on this plan altogether. So that's the way the Sforno deals with this issue. He says, there were only two women, but Paro didn't roll out the plan to the entire country at once. He started with sort of a beta testing. Let's see if this plan has any usefulness if we implement it locally. So he turns to the two women, Shehayu Be'ir Mitzrayim, that were in, you know, his city or his locale. And he says, listen, ladies, when you see the Jewish women giving birth, if it's a boy, kill them. And it doesn't work. So Paro kills the plan. He doesn't continue it further. When he sees that these two women betrayed him and he gave these orders directly to them and they didn't listen, so what's the point of rolling out further? It's certainly going to be less effective if he has to communicate these plans through other people, not himself. No one's going to listen. So that's the way this Sforno deals with this issue. Does everyone understand the Sforno? It makes a lot of sense, but it's a little bit of a read that you have to put into the text. You have to add these details to the text that Paro was only envisioning the role of the plan on a more micro level to his particular locale or his particular region. The Ibn Ezra also says that these two women were just two women, but he echoes the sentiments of the suggestion that was mentioned from the crowd a little bit earlier, and I think this begins to really resonate. The Ibn Ezra writes in source number 10, Vayomer Melech Mitzrayim l'Mialdot, Saros Hayu al Kol ha-Mialdot. What's a sar? An officer, right? They were in charge. These were the two women who were in charge over all the midwives. You know, they had a little company like Midwives and Co., delivering Jewish babies since 1500 BC. I don't know, whatever it is. I made that up. But the point is that they were the ones in charge of the Jewish women. Ki ein safek, writes Ibn Ezra, there's no doubt. Ki yose mechamish meot mialdos hayu. You have to say there were at least 500 Jewish women in the business of midwifery. Ella elu shtehen soros hayu alehen. These two were in charge. Laseis mas lemelech miaskar. Even in those days, ladies, we were paying income tax. That Ibn Ezra says that the role of these two women was to give the mas, was to give the tax that the midwives would have to pay because they were professionals too and had to pay income tax. So Shifra and Puah, whether or not they were Yocheved or Miriam, Ibn Ezra doesn't say. But these two women were the ones interacting with Paro. They delivered the money to Paro. Paro knew them very well. So Paro turned to these two women and he said, listen, I have a message I need you to communicate to all your employees. When you see a Jewish baby being born, if it's a boy, kill the boy. And the Ibn Ezra concludes, V'kacha ra'isi hayom b'mekomos rabos. He says, I see this myself. This is how, or I don't know if he's referring to just midwives or just organizations in general, that there are people in charge and their role is to deliver the tax that the government takes to the government officials. So Shifra and Pua were the government, they were the ones that interacted with the government officials. So he turns to the two heads of midwives and co. and he asked them to spread the word to their ladies. That, at least, could be effective. That, you can make a dent on the Jewish population. Yes. Okay, excellent question. So we'll have to, that's the next point we're going to see in the Malbim. But just look at the Netziv in his commentary on the Torah, HaMikdavar, in source number 11. He echoes the sentiments of the Ibn Ezra. He writes, Lefi hapshat shehin shmosein, if you understand that Shifra and Pua were the names of the ladies, so al korachach lo heino bilvad hayu miyaldot b'chol Yisrael asher garu b'kam arim. They were not the only two Jewish midwives in all the various cities. Elahein hayu hamialdot harashios. They were the ones in charge. Va'alpi pikudas paro alayen yitzavu l'chol hamiyadot asher tachteyen. And based on the commandment that Paro gives to these two women, all the other midwives would follow suit. So now we have at least a plausible explanation of what Paro was thinking. How could he really expect Shifra and Pua to do all the dirty work for such a large nation? The answer is, probably Paro never expected Shifra and Pua to do all the dirty work. He expected that they communicate to all the other midwives to carry out this plan. But now let us address the last question regarding how did Paro ever think that a Jewish woman would kill a Jewish baby? How could that be? Was Paro in such denial? Sorry, because denial, you know, it's the river in Egypt. Okay. But was Paro in such denial that he thought that the Jewish women would carry out his plan? So up to now, note that in all of the Mefarshim that I've shown you, Rashi, the Sforno, the Ibn Ezra, and the Netziv, nobody makes mention of the religion of the midwives. I think people, certainly Rashi is assuming they're Jewish, and we don't see that notion disabused by any of the other Mefarshim until the Malbim. The Malbim in source number 12 writes two important comments. First of all, the Malbim says, Vayomer Melech Mitzrayim, Kfi hapshat amar leha mitzriot. Shahayu miyaldot esa ivrios. According to the simple interpretation, Paro turns to the Egyptian midwives. Someone in my shul, I was giving a smaller version of this shiur yesterday, so someone in my shul came over to me and he said, based on a scholarly work that he was familiar with, that it was commonplace in Egypt in those times that the slaves were given midwives by their masters to help them birth, because it was to the master's advantage that there be more kids and more slaves. So if you take that to be the fact, then it certainly works very nicely with the Malbim that these were Egyptian midwives. No, it doesn't. So if you look back, so that's a very good point. Thank you. It's not says, but if you look back in source number one, it's ambiguous. Look back at the pasuk. Vayomer Melech Mitzrayim lemialdot ha'ivriot. Does it mean that they were Jewish midwives, or does that mean they were the midwives for the Jews? It's ambiguous. Lemialdot ha'ivriot. Well, it could read either way. It could be the Jewish midwives, that's how we were trained in grade school, but it could be the midwives for the Jews. So so this is the ambiguity. The Malbim says it's obvious that these were Egyptian women. That makes a lot of sense, ladies. How would Paro really think a Jewish woman was going to kill a Jewish baby? I think that's ridiculous. The Malbim resonates strongly with me. These were Egyptian women that he speaks to. How many women? So the Malbim says, many, many women. Shifra and Pua are not the names of the ladies, but rather they are the tasks, they're the jobs of the women. Shem HaChad Shifra, V'Shem HaShinis Pua, one of them was called the Shifra, and one of them was called the Pua. It's like when a Jewish woman was giving birth, she said, honey, quickly, call Shifra. She didn't mean Mrs. Shifra, the doctor. We would say, call the doctor. They said, call Shifra, call Pua. It was the task. That was their job. They were called by their professional description. Says the Malbim in source number 12, towards the end of the first line, Vayashay Mine Mialdos. There were two, what's a min? Types. There were two types of midwives. Number one, Achas, Shehaisa Osekes Imhayosheves Alha Mashver. The first one would deal with the woman to help the baby come out of the womb. Vashenis shehaisa osekes im hanolad lichros tivuro v'lasot tzarcho. And the second one's role was to cut the umbilical cord and to deal with the baby. Ha'achas nikre shifra vashenis pua. V'ein perusho shlo hayu rak shtei miyaldos. It doesn't make sense to say there were two midwives. Daha hayu am rav. The rock wrote Zalo Marshne Mine Mialdos. There were two types of midwives. One that dealt with the woman who was birthing, and the other that dealt with the child when he or she came out. This Malbim makes a lot of sense. They were Egyptian midwives, and they were the roles that they played. Not their names, it was the roles that they played. One was to deal with the birthing woman, and the other was to deal with the child when the child was ultimately born. So you understand that if you are able to spend time digging deeper in a text beyond Rashi, and Chas V'Shalom, please do not misinterpret my words, that I am in any way degrading Rashi. That is the farthest from the truth. But I am just using this as an opportunity to remind us all of Shiv and Panim Torah, that there are so many different layers on the text of the Torah. And we, by the way, I'm not finishing, so even though it sounds like I'm finishing, I'm not. We have two more pages to do very quickly. But the point is that there are so many different layers to the text. So we should learn Rashi. We have to learn Rashi. But after we finish with Rashi, we have to look at the Sforno, and then at Siv and the Mab. We have to ask very critical questions to understand the depths of the text. So that deals with the second part in terms of the practicality of the plan. So now let's... Yes? So excellent. These were Egyptian midwives. So why don't we see more babies being killed? First of all, it could be that they were being killed, but it wasn't effective enough. Clearly, Yocheved was very nervous, right? If the word got out very quickly, that there was nothing to worry about, so then what was Yocheved so nervous about? Clearly, there was a fear. So it could be that some of the midwives actually went ahead and were killing the boys, but we also know that, by and large, they didn't. We know that because the Torah tells us that the midwives did not listen to Pharaoh's command. If you look in source number 13, the next group of psukim that we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on, because I want to finish up in a timely fashion, I really would like to look at the last group of psukim, but just for the sake of continuity and completion, so the Torah tells us about Tirena Hamialdos Es Halokim, that the midwives feared the Lord, V'lo Asu Ka'asher Diber Alehen Melech Mitzrayim. They didn't do as Paro asked of them, but Techayena Es Hayiladim. And in fact, they not only did not kill the baby boys, but they brought life to them. The Chazal say they brought them food and water. They were actively involved in sustaining life, not taking away life. Vayikra Melech Mitzrayim Lemiadot. And so Paro is upset. He called to the women. Vayomer Len Madua Sizna Davar Hazeh, but Techayena Es Hayiladim. Why are you doing this, keeping the children alive? Vatomarna Hamialdos El Paro, Kilocha Nashima Mitzrios Ivros, Kichayo Sena, Baterem Tavo Alehan Hamialedes Vayaladu. And the Jewish women, the midwives say, the Jewish women are not like the Egyptian women. They are themselves as skilled midwives. And by the time we get there, they have already given birth. I just want to make two observations about these groups of psukim, and then we'll spend a little bit more time looking at the reward that Hashem gives to these ladies. The Netziv makes a very important comment. The Netziv writes that the Torah uses the word Elokim. Vatirena hamialdos es ha-Elokim. The Torah could have used a different name of God, Hashem, right? Yudke Vavke. But it uses the word Elokim because there was a fear of the judge. And that name, Elokim, really works very nicely with the Malbim, that these were Egyptian women who had a fear of God. It wasn't necessarily the Jewish God, but it was a God. They had a sense of what was morally correct, of ethics, of morality, and they refused to listen to Paro's words. But the Netziv writes that the Torah uses that phrase, Elokim, as opposed to Hashem, to underscore the idea that there was a general fear of heaven that was motivating the actions of these women. And as I said, that worked very nicely with the Malbim. They weren't Jewish women, but they had a fear of God. They had a fear of heaven. They understood what was right and what was wrong. I had envisioned spending more time talking about the heroism of these women, be it Egyptian women, be it Jewish women, although I think that when I was, in my mind, I was going to further extol the virtues of Jewish women in a sense of their commitment to doing what is right, the self-sacrifice that is involved. If you do take Rashi's approach and Chazal's approach, there was Miriam and Yocheved, and they were transmitting this message to the Jewish women, and Paro was out to lunch, and he thought the Jewish women would go through with his plan. All of these women were defying Paro's orders at a risk to their own life. And what an amazing statement of faith and courage this is. About, you know, it's just a tremendous testament to the Jewish woman. I just share with you one quote
Rabbi Soloveitchik, in his very well-known tribute to the Rebbetzin of Tolna, it's a masterful eulogy that he wrote. So he describes the role of Jewish women, and I could not ignore how connected these two sentences were to the narrative that we're reading. So let me just read them to you very quickly. This is, again, the Rav writing in 1978. It's the bottom source. The biblical woman was humble and shy, and yet she possessed an indomitable will and an unshakable determination. She was both simple and tenacious, meek and fearless. The biblical woman was never at the center, always in the wings. She was never loud, always quiet. But then the Rav goes on again to extol the virtues of Jewish women. So if you do take the approach that these are Jewish women, so it certainly sets up the stage for a long, long Jewish history filled with many, many courageous and heroic women that were more than willing to sacrifice for the sake of their religion and the sake of their families. And that should not go unnoted. And if you believe that they were Egyptian women, which I think on some level makes even more sense, so it's just a testament to the intrinsic connection that women have to what is morally correct, what is ethically correct, and it's not surprising that it's a woman here who are saving the day. But let me conclude in the last few minutes with the last group of psukim, focusing on the reward. Because here as well, we have a great deal of confusion. We say, oh, Miriam and Yocheved, Miriam, they got to have Moshe and the kings, and there's not a lot of real understanding of what the reward is that the Torah speaks of. And part of that is because the psukim themselves are ambiguous. Let's look together in source number 18. The Torah tells us, Vayitav Elohim lamialdos, that God does good for the midwives, Vayirev ha'am v'yatzmu ma'od, and the nation continues to proliferate and get larger and more mighty. Vayihi kiru ha'mialdos es Elohim, it was because the midwives feared the Lord, Vayas lehem batim, and he made them houses. So, what was the reward here? What's the complicated nature of the psukim here? What is particularly difficult to understand? Well, I'll start the ball rolling here. Vayitav Elohim lamialdot. God does good for the midwives. What word should follow? Vayas lehem batim. Correct. God does good for the midwives, and he makes them a house, whatever the house represents. But that's not how it flows. The psukim read, and God did good for the midwives, and the nation continued to explode. The population continued to increase. I mean, that's beautiful, and they have a part in that, but how is that like good attributed to them? So Rashi just tells us what I think we generally know. Rashi says, we only know it because of Rashi, by the way. Let me not be misunderstood. It's not like Rashi was sharing that which is self-evident. It's self-evident to us because we have this chus of learning Rashi. But Rashi tells us in source 19, Vayitav Elohim lamialdos, mahu atova vayaslan batim. What is the good? He gives them homes. So Rashi just cuts out the middle words, doesn't he? Vayitav Elohim lamialdos. What is the good? Rashi just turns your attention to the end of the next pasuk, like just completely deleting all the information in the middle. And he says the good is Bate Kahuna Vilavia Umachus Shekri and Batim. They were ultimately the progenitors of the priesthood, the Levites, and the kings. But it leaves a lot lacking from a textual perspective. 2 minutes, is that okay? Yeah. So the Hador Zikanim in source number 20 says something phenomenal, and with this we will close. Says the Hador Zikanim as follows. Think about it. Shifra and Pua go to Paro. Paro is furious. How dare you defy orders to keep the Jewish boys alive? Death, you should be killed. Defying Paro's orders. So they come up with this excuse, you know, well, the Jewish women, they're very skilled, and by the time we get there, they're already alive. So Paro says, you're liars. And they say, no, we're not. Look at the birth rate. They're exploding. The fact that the Jewish women are having so many babies was ultimately the way Shifra and Pua legitimized their excuse. It wasn't even an excuse, it was true. Vayitav Elohim lamialdos, says the Hadar Zikanim, God did good for the Jewish women, for these midwives rather. You know why he did good for them? Because the nation continued to grow. So their excuse was actually legitimized and Pyro didn't kill them. But that writes the Hadar Zikanim in source number 20, he first quotes Rashi, Perish HaKunchas Mahi Yatovai Vayaslam Batim. God made homes for them. Vikasha Share Pasuk Echad Mapsik Bein Tayim. But the Hadar Zakim says, but that doesn't make sense because the Pasuk interjects. Lekach Nirali Dahatova Haisa Meha Dixi Vayare Va'am. That the good is that the people became more numerous. Kiza Haisa Tova. This was good for the midwives. Lefish Amru Tachila Laparo. Because they went to Paro and said, oh, the women there, they're so skilled, they're having babies, they don't need us. Paro says, you're liars. But when Paro sees how numerous the nation continues to be, Omar Paro says, Vaday emes hein dovros. No, you know what? They were telling me the truth. He actually says the two midwives themselves can't give birth to all of these children. But I think more globally what he's saying is that the excuse of the midwives was legitimized by the explosive population growth. And that's why, it's unbelievable what he says. Vayaslan batim, paro. Look back at Pasuk Chaf Aleph. Vayhi kiryu hamyaldos es Elokim. When the midwives feared God, and they weren't killing the baby, so Paro says, I have to come up with plan B. So you know what Paro's plan B was? I will build Egyptian homes next to the Jewish homes, so that when I hear a baby crying, the Egyptian can go in and kill the baby. Vayas lahem batim is Paro. Paro makes the batim. Paro makes the batim. V'haynu hadichsi vayas lahem batim kai amitzrayim. Also, lahem leMitzrayim batim ben bateya ivriim liyada matayil dunusho sehem. Paro makes homes. He makes the Egyptians live amongst the Jewish women, Jewish families, so that the Egyptians can hear when the baby is born. Ladies, what do we call the holiday that we celebrate when they left Egypt? Pesach. Why Pesach? Asher pasachti al batei Mitzray, al batei Yudim. I'm not only the pasuk in front of you. What do we call Pesach? Because Hashem says, I jumped over the Jewish homes and I killed the Egyptians. They were living as one? The answer is, yeah, from here. Vayas lahem batim. Paro makes the homes for the Jewish, for the Egyptian people amongst the Jewish families so he can keep closer tabs on the Jewish women when they give birth. So that's a beautiful read, and it also brings a whole new dimension of understanding to the language that the Torah uses when describing the miracle of Pesach. And that's why the Hadar Zakenim says, "V'hainu pasachti." That's why God says, "I jumped over the homes." Kolomer shadile kamakom mibeis hamitzri lebeis mitzri acher lefisha beisel shayisrael ha'isavemza. The Jewish homes were in the middle. So according to the Hadar Zakenim, "Va'itavlo kimla miyados." God does good for them. What is the good? They continue to have babies. They legitimize their excuse. Their life is spared. Vayik Yeruham Yeldos Eselokim. And when Paro sees that these women have a fear of the Lord, they're not carrying out his plan. Vayas Lahem Batim. Paro makes homes for the Egyptians amongst the Jewish families, and then he asks the Egyptians to go ahead and throw all the baby boys into the Nile. There's so much more to be said. My time is up, but I hope after the hour that we spent learning together, you have a new dimension of understanding. It's not just the same story that your children, you yourself, had the zechus of hearing from your moros. It's a beautiful when you're a younger child, but we have to understand the story on a more complex and nuanced level. So thank you for learning with me, and I hope you enjoyed as much as I enjoyed teaching.